I like my background, I, it's modified from the installer.
I installed the default desktop.
Fedora installation, past, present, and future. In theory, I'm qualified to talk about this. So, the installer used for Fedora Core and previously for Red Hat Linux and for Red Hat Enterprise Linux is called Anaconda. And there's a great story behind that, but I can't tell you unless, because if I did, then I'd have to tell you. It supports text mode installs, graphical installs, and then also there's an automated installation called Kickstart. Just lovely, and there are people that really like it, like Seth, wherever he's hiding, and Jesse. Everybody loves Kickstart. There's also another mode that's sort of a command line mode that just prints out the step that it's going to, and it only works with Kickstart, and I wrote it for S390, but I really didn't want to go into that in the slides. So, like I said, Anaconda is used for Fedora Core, it was used for Red Hat Linux, it's used for Red Hat Enterprise Linux. The Progeny people have picked it up and ported it to work with App, and also with Specifics have ported it to work with Conary. The Specifics people is easy to understand because it's Matt Wilson who was one of the original developers on Anaconda, so it makes sense. Most of the code is written in Python, although I thought I had slides, I think I forgot to write this slide. Or lost this slide with OpenOffice crash and I went to magic one. I'll get there. So what architectures can you use Anaconda on? Right now, x86, x86-64, Itanium, IBM P-Series, IBM I-Series, S390 and S390X. PPCs mostly. There's a couple bugs in the Mac, well, but it's mostly there. It mostly works. Spark sometimes works.
Kind of, maybe.
When Scott and Peter fix things up. Alpha's worked once upon a time. It's probably completely
gone out of it.
But, you know, I figured I'd list it anyway. My original slide had a nice little disclaimer for those three of not fully supported, but there's code there to pretend it works. Okay, so I'm not going to go forward yet. So I was going to talk a little bit just about the basic architecture of the installer, because especially if people file bugs or want to know why things are the way they are, they get really confused. So basically there are two parts to the installer. There's a first stage and a second stage. The first stage is all written in C, and it needs to be kept on the small side because it's all loaded basically from an NRD. NRD or in the NIT-RAMFS now with FC4, and it basically has to do everything possible to get you to the second stage. So basically, if you're doing a network install, it has to be able to bring your network up, get you on the network, and actually start pulling the second stage image. If you're doing a CD install, it has to be able to get there. If you're doing a hard drive install, it has to be able to get to your hard drive to get the ISO images. So there's a fair bit of hardware-specific stuff. There's all the module loading that needs to happen. There's things like loading USB so that you can use your USB keyboard and mouse. And all of that is all in the first stage, and for the longest time, that all had to fit on a floppy disk with the kernel. Yeah, that was fun. With the 2.6 kernel, this just really isn't doable anymore. The 2.6 kernel is large. It fills just about a meg, which would leave me about 400K, not for all the modules that would be needed, for any modules that are needed, and code to load them, and display stuff, and do stuff in other languages. So, yeah, boot floppies aren't anymore. This is why we now have boot CDs, or you have there's an image that you can put on your USB key, and it works, and it's great. Then you get to the second stage. We exec user bin Anaconda, which is a Python program, and everybody gets happy because it's all of a sudden so easy to change things, fix things, to put in your own updates, and things like that. I really probably looking around the room and knowing some of the people in the room, you know, I really should have done more of the how you can also do customizations of Anaconda as part of this, but alas, I didn't. You'll just have to ask me the questions and then I'll tell you. So let's look a little bit at the history of Anaconda, how far we've come. So before Anaconda, there was a nice, simple, text-based installer that was all written in C, and it was impossible to change anything, and anybody who ever wanted to change anything and didn't want to do it, kill themselves. So...
Not with Anaconda.
We get Red Hat Linux 6.1, which replaced that C text-based installer, was written in Python, used PyGTK, was graphical and not just text-based, and it looked beautiful. That's a screenshot from the docs. I didn't actually manage to find the 6.1 CD. Yeah, you would have expected the trace back. The other nice thing about the 6.1 installer is there were actually buttons that existed that actually did nothing at all. You could click them and they did nothing.
Like the install button.
No, not the install. It was actually about half the bootloader screen didn't do anything. It was really cool. Matt Wilson came to the Lugged NC State right after 6.1 was released and was demoing the install. And I don't think he actually did get through the install. This was Disk Druid at the time. It's a wonderful little partition editor. It was basically, we had this, the stuff was written in C, that all existed. Let's write some simple bindings to Python and just display the same stuff in a GUI. That's all most of the first pass. Not the most beautiful thing in the world, but hey, it worked. And all of a sudden you could do software rate. That was the first. I didn't include that anymore. So then we get the Red Hat Linux 7X. With this, we get the advent of needing to support multiple CDs, because for some reason there are all these people that keep writing all this open source software and translating it. So it keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And so it didn't all fit on one CD anymore. So multiple CDs it is. And that involves a lot of fun because you're running the second stage off of the first CD. So there's a nice little kernel patch that lets us copy that to the hard drive and then say, tell the loopback device, you know that file you were looking at? Well, it's not there anymore. Now it's here. Trust me. This is always interesting. In Red Hat Linux 7.1, Anaconda was updated to support the 2.4 kernel, nothing major. And the biggest change during the 7X series was that this Druid that you saw before that used something called libfdisk, that really was let's take fdisk and make a library out of it, was swapped to use Pardit. And here's some screenshots. You see we went from 640 by 480 to 800 by 600. The graphics are starting to look a little better. Matt did draw all of them now. And the new Discord, you know, a little better. Crappy GTK1 tree. And you get some graphical idea of what the drive looks like and how it's partitioned. Red Hat Linux 8.0 was a fun release, especially because it sort of happened almost twice. With Red Hat Linux 8.0, we ported everything to Python 2. That wasn't a big deal. GTK 2, which was a major deal, because GTK 2 wasn't done. PyGTK 2 had barely been started. So we ported PyGTK in a lot of cases, too. Support for LVM was added because, well, LVM went to the kernel for Red Hat Linux 7.3, and people wanted to install to it. I don't know why. And instead of the old text-based comps file that had all of the dependencies listed in it, we went to an XML file because it just made things easier to parse and people to modify. And people have done all sorts of weird XSLT XSLT things with it now. So this is sort of, you know, GTK 2, you start seeing, you know, the buttons are starting to look nicer. This is before we put all of the blue card stuff in the installer, some of the icons and the like are difficult to get. Let's see. Package progress. This was an especially fun release because we had really good ads during the install. With great power comes great responsibility was perhaps one of the best. And they did get up in the docs.
The payments had really good pictures too.
Yeah. Garrett had all kinds of good artwork in that movie. Red Hat Linux 9, the installer, had some stuff that I couldn't think of anything to note, so I didn't include slide for it. Fedora Core 1 and RHEL 3, and actually a lot of this work went into Red Hat Linux 9 too, added a lot of the modularity for doing different products. because this was the time at which the great Fedora, Red Hat Linux, Red Hat Enterprise Linux stuff was all happening. And, you know, I needed to not have to rebuild the installer when I wanted to go from an installer for Fedora Core to an installer for Red Hat Enterprise Linux to an installer for before I started working at Red Hat. The Realm kit for Red Hat Linux for NC State. So, you know, basically made a lot of things a lot more modular, a lot of things able to be swapped out just based on what files were in certain places, lots of architecture porting, multi-lib support for x86-64. You heard Seth talking about multi-lib dev solvers, and you might start to understand the pain that was, especially since I was the first person to break RPM doing so. Fedora Core 2 and 3 and RHEL 4, there was porting to 2.6, which was not fun. The wonderful fun that was SE Linux, thanks to Dan. Fedora Core 3 and RHEL 4, we switched to actually doing auto partitioning using LVM by default. Basically, all of the space that is of the type you specified will make physical volumes out of it, and then we'll make a volume group and make some logical volumes. Support for doing installs over wireless, which is kind of nice. RTL languages. So most text that most people are used to goes from left to right, but there are languages like Arabic that actually go from right to left. And adding support for that, some of the index scripts. Anaconda is up to something like 45 languages that are at install time in FC3.
When's Redneck coming back?
When is Redneck coming back? When somebody submits the translation.
Actually, legal won't let that go through the last I heard.
I don't think it has anything to do with legal.
Legal may not let it go through, legal but if I commit it, then
send me a profile.
What they don't know won't hurt.
I think all it needs to be done is somebody needs to properly internationalize Redneck, and it can go in.
I mean, the thing is, Redneck actually, the real reason why Redneck went out was it was done as ENRN, which isn't a real locale, and so that broke things all kinds of ways after install. So if instead we do ENUS at Redneck, then that will make GLibc fall back properly and everything will just work.
Nice.
So I'm just waiting on somebody to volunteer to head up the translation team. If you're interested in doing this, let me know and I can put you in touch with the proper people and we can get it added.
That's not the interesting challenge. The interesting challenge is Aquino and Sibiri.
Yeah. So plans for Fedora Core 4. And some of these are underway, some of them aren't, we'll see. The biggest one is that I basically went through and ripped out a lot of handwritten GTK and made it so that we could start using Quinn. Because handwritten GTK, for all the fun that it is to write once, it's not fun to change, ever. So basically all of the base structure of the installer is now Glade, but the plan is not to go through and try and change every screen to Glade at once because that's a lot of work for not a lot of gain. Instead, as we have to go in and start actually making modifications to specific screens, we're going to switch them out at that point. Or, you know, if I get bored one day and just been looking for something fun to do that's not playing with an S390 or something, then I'll switch a screen to Glade. Chris, who I thought I saw, but maybe I didn't see him. Oh yeah, he's in the back corner. He has switched out our handling of URL lib2 directly in the Python parts of Anaconda to switch to URL wrapper, which gives us a lot of advantages and moves us closer to being able to do some of the other future things. It'll make a lot of things like mirroring, retries, and error handling sane. Lots of bug fixing is in the works because I've basically been the only person working on Anaconda for a long time, and now there are more people. So hopefully we're going to go through and clean up a lot of the bugs, just if they've built up. And I'm working on Xen virtualization, which I talked about earlier. And so there are going to be some installer-related changes for virtualization. So some more eye candy screenshots. This is sort of the installer running in test mode on my laptop CVS checkout yesterday. This morning at 1 o'clock. You can see that there's a little bit more spacing between things because everything is just sort of using the normal GNOME human interface guideline spacing. All of the sort of border stuff is done with Blade, and then that's on it, but that's kind of what they're doing. This is the language selection screen, which is just kind of cool because you can see this is just a small subset of some of the languages. Bulgarian, Chinese, Czech, Hindi, and you know, Arabic. And even the buttons actually flip properly now. That was a bug for a while. Feature ideas, some of the things that probably aren't going to get done for Fedora Core 4, but we're going to keep working on it and hopefully finish it sometime.
And the patches you sent us.
Yeah, patches always accepted. Switching to using Yum for our dev solver as opposed to the dev solver that's existed forever within Anaconda is a big thing. That'll let us then move to the point where we can let you say, I want to add this repository at install time, which will give people like Matt here, you know, instead of having to completely respin the installer for BU's changes, they can start with exactly the same thing and just have a default of, you know, also go look at this repository to add some more packages, which is really going to be a great help to that. It'll help a lot with things like extras, and being able to install updates at install time, being able to do an upgrade and include extras at the same time and not have to go all to hell. Continuing to Gladify things just because it's the right thing to do. Like the partitioning dialogues are a nightmare. I'd like to get to a more streamlined install process.
There's a way you can streamline it. So what we do, I think, about the way it works right now is, in spite of the fact that there's an effective machine to detect when you put a CD on the drive, you still have to click a button to tell it to go.
Yeah, well, I'm actually thinking even bigger scale than that, that right now you basically have to click next something like 12 times to get through the install.
Yeah.
If you've been through a SUSE install in a while, they do something where they ask you a lot fewer questions and then let you just go change some of the defaults. That's sort of the direction I'm going. I've got some different ideas on exact implementation and things like that, and some of the things they don't ask that I really think they should. But like, realistically, why should we have to go and specify network settings definitely? A lot of it is, you know, we can set up defaults. We're going to use Network Manager by default. And, you know, if that's not exactly what you want, then we can change it after the fact. And if you're using Kickstart, all of the functionality you need is still going to pretty much remain there for Kickstart defaults. But for the person sitting down and going through an install, we want to make it even simpler. Kickstart improvements. I got the question via email today of, I'm doing a Kickstart install. How can I verify that my Kickstart config is valid other than sticking it in the machine and watching to see if it blows up, which I'm sure the people who use Kickstarter are well aware of. And as it stands right now, the Kickstarter config has no grammar to speak of. Really, having that as a flat text file was great 6 or 7 years ago, but probably something a little bit more structured would be good for now, would be better now. Probably if we do that, we'll have to sort of have dual parsers for a while or some way to convert from the old format to the new, which then brings into account all of the problems with having validation, but then we could solve the validation problem and actually have something that is editable by system config Kickstart, and it just cleans things up.
What sort of new format are you talking about?
Probably something that's XML. It makes it a pain to edit by hand, but it's doable. I edit comps files by hand all the time, so you know, I'm crazy. Also, as Kickstart is currently implemented, it basically drives things similar to being graphical or text mode, but it's not really, so I want to go through and actually change things so that instead of being sort of an install type, you know, a way of visualizing the install, it's more of a data source, which then starts to make things that people have wanted forever, like being able to save the state before you start to install packages as a Kickstart config. That starts to be reasonable. Some references. There's an Anaconda project page on fedora.redhat.com. There's a mailing list. There's Bugzilla.
all sorts of things like that.
Is it part of this, it lays out that the determines the part where you have the graphics, you know, the graphics card and the
So he asked if Anaconda takes into is the part that does all of hardware probing, determining what drivers push what. And so that's actually the lower level. Anaconda depends on Kudzu for doing that. My guess is that over time, it looks like in a lot of ways, we're probably going to end up having to switch to using HAL, which is a freedesktop.org project for doing device discovery and handling device information. It has a nice, easy way for vendors to distribute files to describe configuring their device, similar to INET files.
My last two Dell notebooks, it still can't figure out the screen.
So the problem with LCDs is that all of our video probing for monitors uses real mode BBE probing, which LCDs don't support at all. And doing anything more than that requires doing something that's specific to the exact video card you have, which would mean writing something different for each one. Now, X already has all this code. This is the best part. X has code to do this. So, personally, I'm of the opinion that really X needs to be fixed so that X just automatically gets it right. And instead of having, you know, everybody configuring something differently, X should get it right, and then you should have a way to override X, X's configuration. But if we got to a point where I didn't write on Xconfig at all, where if my Xconfig said run at this resolution, I would be so incredibly happy. We're not there.
Do you have a guess as to what you might do?
I know that that's actually one of the things that the people working on Xorg are interested in, is getting that a lot more, you know, streamlined, a lot simpler. I'll go to the next slide, because, you know, basically I'm to the point where I'm just going to take other calls, questions, and we can talk for half an hour, because this isn't a long presentation. I can do it in seconds. How long it's going to be, it's hard to say. I think the big thing that has to happen first is that the big split up of Xorg into a non-monolithic blob of individual components has to happen first. And from there, then it starts getting to be easier for other people to actually start working on those parts, and at which point people start figuring things like that out and start being able to more actively work on that.
Is that happening?
That's in progress. It just keeps getting bogged down by other things. Originally it was going to be, oh, this will be done in time for FC 2, then 3. Now, I don't know what the current status is. I kind of lost track because I've started dealing with virtualization instead.
Since the sitting on a floppy disk is no longer an issue, can the first stage loader go away, basically?
So Matt asked if the first stage loader can go away now that we no longer have to fit on a floppy.
Or get smaller.
The big problem is that although we don't have to fit in a floppy, all of that is loaded into RAM. So however big it is, that's that much overhead on installs.
Also, TFTP is on checksum, so
yeah.
For network you want
PXC stuff.
So I'm pretty, you know, I personally like having, you know, keeping that on the small side. We probably are going to move to basically, instead of having modules spread between the first stage and the second stage, which was done because of the floppy reason, have all of the modules in the init RD, because then to go to a new kernel if you need to for whatever reason, then you just have to update the kernel in the init RD and not the kernel in the init RD in the second stage. Which, yes, it is a major, major, major pain. As I, you know, try to get new hardware working that's not released with RHEL updates, doing that has cost me, you know, I don't know how long of my life, that I will never, ever get back. It's funny, that's a lot of what actually motivates what I've done. A lot of the things that I've worked on have been, these were things that have been a pain point for me in the past, or it's something that other people have suggested. But if it's a pain point for me, then it gets a much higher... Yeah, it's moved way up the scale of things I fix.
So, what do you use to try to do mitigation and expanding that other way?
I'll get to that. I'll answer Dustin's question first, because I think it would be easy.
I'm curious, you know, as this live-seed effort evolves, do you see changes in the installer to accommodate that? I mean, what happens when somebody puts a live CD in and says, this is cool, I like it, but right now I'm ready to transfer it to hard drive?
So, live CDs fill an interesting niche. I think that having the live CD have the ability to kick off a real install is valuable, but I'm not sure that you want to be able to just, you know, do some sort of transfer of what's on the live CD, because in a lot of cases, live CDs have interesting setup just to take account for the fact that they're running off of a read-only media. And although we're trying to get as much of the general infrastructure for that as possible, you know, that's not ever going to 100% be there. It's always going to be a little bit different in some way. Plus things like updates and, you know, bits and pieces will probably be carved out just because of space considerations. So I don't know what the end goal with live CDs is. I'd like, you know, Dirk, whose last name I can't think of, Westfall, has done some stuff with live CDs with Fedora. And he sent mail saying he's looking at trying to move to using Anaconda to create the live CD. And that makes a lot of sense to me. That ends up looking a lot like sort of creating a virtual machine or creating a stateless install.
Right,
and then we can sort of get to all of those sort of being the same thing.
Right, that was my question. Will that involve changes to Anaconda, or is that entirely separate?
My guess is that it will probably, anything that utilizes Anaconda ends up requiring some changes. What Stateless has done so far that utilized Anaconda, they already had to make some changes. Jonathan made them, he committed them, and he only broke one thing. So I didn't beat him up too bad for it. But, so yeah, I do think that getting to the point where the installer can create these arbitrary images for other purposes than installing on this specific hardware is a direction that's going to have to be moved in. It's just not necessarily a fast or short road. Let me get to Matt's other question first. So virtualization. My talk earlier, which if you didn't see, you can go watch the OG video later. Basically, we're integrating Xen into Fedora. As it stands right now, we have the packages for the kernel, we have the tools there, and we have some of the basic infrastructure we need. I'm currently being a kernel hacker and not actually working on Anaconda, and creating basically support for probing and displaying devices that exist within your guest virtual machine, so that eventually I can say, now I want to create a virtual machine and install to it. I want to get to the point where basically you say, you start up, you know, your VM control program or something, and it basically has the, what file, where do you want to put your backing store? How big do you want it to be? How many networks do you want? How many network interfaces do you need? How many CPUs, things like that. And what do you want to install? Pick where your install media is. Say go. It goes ahead and creates the virtual machine config, starts the installer from the tree you pointed it at, and lets you do the installation into that, pulling back via VNC to do a graphical install. And then you have, you know, virtual machines. And then, you know, the obvious extension there is the simple tool that lets you have a slightly modified kickstart config, and then you can start doing all sorts of cool provisions. So, Seth has raised his hand next.
It would be worthwhile as an installer if you, once it gets to the point where it's starting to pull in multiple repositories, to check to make sure you can go on any further if the repositories are just going to play things. Like, none of those things because the repositories combined are not active.
Right. So, as it stands right now, Anaconda, if you get to a point where there really are no, there is no path out for dependencies, I just say, well, I'm going to do the best I can, because otherwise you're just sitting in the installer and there's not much you as a user can do about it. As there's support for multiple repositories, it may be you've hit a conflict, we're going to disable this repository and you're not going to be able to do your install using it or something like that. I'm sure that something like that's going to be needed. The worst case is that, you know, we just do like we do now and you end up with a system that's a little bit inconsistent at the end. I'm not sure if one is really that much worse or better than the other. It's kind of six of one, half dozen of another. Other questions? Spot raised his hand.
So the internet asks when Anaconda will be themeable.
The internet asks when Anaconda is themeable, just not at install time. Anaconda is themeable to people who are creating, you know, derived distributions or distributions using Anaconda by changing the scripts. I'm not saying it's easy, but it can be done. There are some things that are simpler, things like changing
up. Might make it so we can do that if we really want it to as a large.
Well, so the Glade stuff doesn't actually make it any easier at all. The one thing that does make it easier is you can drop a file called product.image in your Fedora base or Red Hat base if you're on Red Hat Enterprise Linux directory. It's an EXT2 formatted file, loopback mount it, and create a pixmaps directory, and you can put new images in there. And then you can replace the images that are shown by the installer for things like the banner at the top or the splash screen and things like that. And I think Matt may have done that, maybe you did. And Jack only did, but there are people who have done it because I told them to. And you can also replace install classes there.
Which you did because I was complaining about it for years.
And I was complaining about it for years.
Is that different than, at least with RHEL3, you had the RH updates directory?
So the RH updates directory is something different.
Since a remote.
RH updates is, you know, the NFS only really way of doing updates. The more generic form is updates.image in Fedora base or Red Hat base. Similarly, ext2 formatted file, and you can basically put update Python files in there, which really lets you get to about anything you want. If you put a file Anaconda in there that's executable, it'll run that instead of user bin Anaconda, so you can really do all sorts of fun things. Or more usefully, you can do all sorts of things like starting GDB on the installer, so that you can find out, get a backtrace when it crashes. Not that I've done things like that. Once or twice.
So, when I recently installed Fedora, I installed everything, and noticed that there were way too many services, at least my humble opinion, that was started. So then I went back just to compare, and I said, okay, I must have got to that since I installed everything, and I installed just the desktop distribution. It still seemed like there were infinite amount of services.
So one problem is that everything is now getting to the point where everything needs a server. It doesn't help the fact that NFSv4 requires something like 8 daemons or something stupid like that. But things like Dbus and HAL and a lot of the desktop things like that are requiring actually having a server running to be able to do either authentication or to be able to pass messages back and forth. To be honest, the number of network-facing services should be close to zero. It's pretty minimal. I mean, SSH listens, and there was a thread about stopping that, and I said no, because unfortunately, although from the perspective of, you know, absolute security, having SSH listening is bad, from the point of view of, you know, lots of weird architectures and also some virtualization stuff, having SSH running is extremely useful. You pretty much can't do anything on an S390 without it, for example, because the console is just far too unwieldy. So if there are specific services that are running, especially that are listening on the network, file bugs.
One thing that can help would be, I guess when you're in setup, you can go through services and you can hit F1, except of course on the default distribution you can't hit F1 because it's bound to help.
Right.
But once you change that, you can hit F1, but the descriptions aren't really good and doesn't make clear which ones may or may not be secure.
And the descriptions come entirely from the services themselves. So
from the spec file, or where do they come from?
From the init script.
Okay.
So if you look at the top of the init script, there's a description section, that's sucked down. So Spot has another question from the interweb.
Yeah, there's actually two questions from the interweb.
Okay.
The first question is, what's the feasibility of having the installer act as a full functional X session while doing a desktop install in the background, presumably so you can play things like Tetris?
The big problem with doing that is that then requires putting that much more in the image that's used at install time, and that thing is already up to like 75 megs due to fonts, and I'd like to shrink it, not make it bigger, because there are cases where that gets transferred down and does increase the RAM usage.
Second question is, what about chroot installs with Anaconda?
Chroot installs with Anaconda. There is an undocumented, unsupported, sometimes working mode that does that. I'm not sure that chroot installs is going to be all that interesting, especially as things like Xen pick up, because using Xen over chroot is, you know, not much overhead, and you get a lot more advantages as far as isolation. So I'm leaning more towards, you know, getting things working for the Xen case as opposed to caring as much about the chroot case, just because the chroot case ends up being really weird.
I was
going
to say, in regards to Tetris, who's even like I read it at once had that. Probably textbook Tetris.
Yeah, I mean, there's Tetris terminals. If you want to compile it, set up and get an RX.
Caldera also had Tetris in Lizard, which was their graphical installer for Caldera Open Linux 2.0 many years ago. But the problem is you can't do Tetris for legal reasons. And picking a game, you're not going to pick a game everybody likes.
Just put Adventure on TTY5, we'll be good.
Okay. No, you're in Adventure, it is the install.
Twisty little install
CD-ROM. Exactly.
Yes.
Right.
I have one more question. I've been to this in my laptop.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, it comes from Dell with Windows on it. No
right.
Resources. And, but my second disk, I put the Fedora.
Right.
The one thing that would be very, very helpful is that when you go to install it, it should automatically since Windows and set up everything where you can access that disk without having to go in and open it when you do a mount and all that.
So there are a couple of potential problems there. So in cases where it's VFAT or something like that, then HAL should be going ahead and setting everything up now. Where it's NTFS, We hit the area where I've been told by our legal department I can't talk about it. That's the unfortunate thing is that, especially now, any machine that you buy with Windows pre-installed is going to have NTFS.
Could you not? I mean, I specified that 32.
Right.
So that they wouldn't screw it up. But I know there's sites with module and the module.
So if the module's there?
What I'm suggesting is for the things that the legal department don't want to touch, at least if there's something to come up and say, there's a link and there's a place.
The problem is, so go read this month's Red Hat magazine, especially the Ask Shadow Man column and the part about contributory infringement. Is my best answer for that.
Okay. But speaking just to beat that, what about the option to automatically shrink VFAT partitioning for Linux?
So resizing has been on my list of things to do forever, but it keeps getting less and less important because the number of machines that are using VFAT as opposed to NTFS is...
So IBM laptops are all still shipped with VFAT until you turn them on.
It is a rapidly shrinking, you know, portion. And doing resizing is going to have to happen because we're going to have to be able to get to the point where you can do resizing of your logical volumes. And once that's there, then it's trivial to do partitions too. It's just that it requires a reasonable amount of work to get the part F code into shape and then actually tie that all in. The other thing is that finding how much you can resize in advance of actually doing the resize operation isn't always deterministic, and we put off doing commits of changes to your disk partitions until right before you install, and so that's, there's a little bit of a problem, there's a little bit of a conceptual problem there, but there are a couple of ways around that too.
Okay.
Jesse.
So what's the state of MC4 in two greater than 2.7 terabyte devices? How does Anaconda react when it finds a disk, not necessarily the boot disk, but the A disk that has a block size of greater than 2.7 terabytes?
No clue. How's that for a fair answer?
If I get you a machine, what's the idea?
One thing that's a problem right now is that the kernel does have some problems. Steven's been working on that the past couple weeks. That's why I know that there's problems. The theory is that if you have a non-boot disk that's over 2 terabytes in size, what we should do is detect that it's A, not your boot disk, B, it's over 2 terabytes in size, and instead of trying to put an MS-DOS partition table on it, which won't work, put GPT on it. And all of the ugly. So GPT is the next generation partition table developed by Intel and Microsoft for Itanium. And it's making its way over onto non-Itanium. Like iPod. And the GPT detection code screwed up iPods for a long time, too. That's the other thing. So,
someone earlier asked, why LVM by default?
Why LVM by default?
That's the right answer.
Very simply, because plenty of users, if you have a desktop machine, you know, I have many times done the, I do an install and then I'm running out of space, so I bought another disk and I plugged it in. And then I either had to do a lot of shuffling myself or reinstall or something like that. With LVM, you can add the disk, and eventually the goal is have, you know, the machine notices, oh, you added a new disk, tell you, you've added a new disk, would you like to make this part of this existing volume group? You say yes, and expand your logical volumes. That's sort of the goal. Not all of the bits are in place, but before any of the other stuff can happen, you really have to start getting people using the LVM.
Right. This is relating to this 2 terabyte thing, and I haven't tested this on floor 3.
Right.
So it might get fixed. We had users with 3 terabyte file systems. They weren't touching them or doing anything, but since they were attached, they would bond with
them. So that got broken. That was broken by the kernel. Cardan uses an ioctl, and the kernel passed things back that didn't make any sense at all. And this should be fixed with the 2.6 kernel.
Okay, so it's probably.
It should be fixed.
Yeah, I haven't tried it with the 2.6 kernel. I just wanted.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. There's about 5 duplicates of the bug. And there's a patch in one of them for 2.4 that supposedly doesn't quite cover everything, but for the 2.6 case, it should be better. And if it's not, then hopefully we'll fix that update.
What about officially supporting upgrading places?
The big problem with that is that a lot of times we make big changes that are kind of hard to do that with. Dev to UDev is one that springs to mind. It works okay, but it's really hard to do in place, and I have a lot more flexibility if the glibc and the system I'm running on are not the same one I'm trying to do these major changes to. Things like the 2.4 to 2.6 kernel upgrade made my head want to explode for some of the stuff, and in some cases, it just had to be a, if you're in this specific subset of cases doing this specific thing, I have to do manual fixings. And just trying to encode that in some way that could be done in a percent post or something on a running system is really difficult. That's pretty much the barrier. And you know, most of the times it can't work. It says it's going to add stuff here.
I'm going to ask one time.
Oh,
okay. Would it be possible to do to set up something like, you don't update as much as possible, but none of the stuff is crazy, and then including the non-crazy stuff, all the crazy stuff?
The problem is the non-crazy stuff ends up depending on the crazy stuff, and it's... And it just spirals out of control.
What about something in between thing where you can do a remote computer without or having access to it?
BNC.
You can't do that today, can you?
Yeah, BNC.
BNC is working, right?
BNC is supported in the installer. It works very, very nice.
Yeah, all you do is do a Kickstart, tell BNC install, you leave out certain places, connect to BNC, it's fantastic because you do the whole thing remotely and you don't have an X capable terminal available on the client on their website at all. Have it on your client.
But how do you start it off to begin with?
Pixie.
Or putting the kernel in an NRD in your grub config and rebooting.
Yeah.
There are all kinds of tricks.
Use the VM and the NRD from the images Pixie directory Rome manages to do a kernel for the wconfig reboot as that one is default, it comes up in your VT. Yeah, it's great.
Okay.
Great.
Anything else? Any suggestions? Come on, who did I have good suggestions? I thought somebody was coming up with a beat me up. That's what I was told. Like, Matt's very much just. In the back?
Yeah, you mentioned that the LVM is defaulted in automatically. Does that include the sustain stuff with the GLVM? Or is
so that doesn't set up clustered LVM, and I'm going to go ahead and say I haven't used the LVM at all yet. My assumption is that you can go from a standard LVM setup to a CLVM setup very simply, but I haven't actually used it to bear out that assumption. Yes?
For the text-based install, is there any thought about cleaning up the partitioning page? It's gotten a little bit cluttered over time.
The one big problem is with the text-based installer, I'm limited to 80 columns and 25 lines. And I can only use those in so many different ways. I want to get to the point where there is no case where X fails. If X fails to start up, that is the bug. That's the thing that should be fixed. And trying to work around it by saying, oh, there's the text mode installer you can use instead, is just, you know, like saying, I broke my foot, let me, you know, hop around on one leg or something.
I guess, but on the server, you usually don't care about X configuration at all anyway.
But at the same time, it should still work. There's no reason for it not to work. And if you're doing, the other thing is VNC, is because, to be honest, text mode is a lost cause. I'm never going to get things like ending. I'm never going to get things like Arabic working. And so you just have to decide there's a point at which you have to lost.
So if you do the VNC thing, can you make it skip the X configuration of the hardware program but still do graphical mode?
There actually is a thing you can pass that tells it that you're on a headless box, and then it doesn't even try and do it. I think you add headless to the command line, but I have to actually go double check.
Another way to look at that is do everything except this partitioning by kickstart. Drop out this partitioning in the kickstart section, write skip X in there, or the graphical the whole way like normal, like you would in graphical install, lets you do partitioning the disk via VNC interactively, and then after that you walk away, you're done.
No, but that's exactly how we do our installs right now. We do them in text mode.
Do them in VNC.
Yes.
All much better.
I just don't know how much more I can clean. Yeah.
So
it was like I kind of.
Go away then.
That's my hope. I'd love for it to die. a painful death that, you know, with flames coming out the top and things like this.
Do you have concern with test mode going away for accessibility or blackout?
No. Again, fixing the wrong problem. If the reason to keep text mode around is because of blind users, why can we not fix the graphical mode instead? Because, you know, we have all of this accessibility stuff, we have all of ATK. What are we missing, and let's make that happen, let's not clutch around it. Because it's not like we include speak up in our kernel anyway, so. Okay, so, Paul?
Maybe this is too long a question, but I haven't looked at the LVM stuff at all in Kickstart,
eat your brain.
Trying to
awesome.
Yeah.
it works.
I think I mentioned this to you at OLS last year, but one frustration I have with Kickstart is that I have all kinds of different machines, and some of them are IDE and some of them are SCSI, and I want to define a couple of partitions that get created, but I don't care what kind of disk is on the machine. But I don't want my root partition to be on this disk and my swap to be on that disk. You know,
so
if there's some sort of, I mean, I don't know is there any thought of it, while you're making modifications to Kickstart to do some changes to the syntax for specifying partitions so you can just say things like, put it on the first disk, or whatever you think that is.
So I can get the two answers.
All right. Yeah.
Do you want to go first, Justin?
I was just
going to
say that I've experienced this, and that what I ended up doing was writing Python scripts that tie into Anaconda that basically skip over Anaconda's whole figuring out what partitions to throw disks at, and instead use our own partitioning formula based on what disk it finds first and sorting it correctly. And that typically works whether you're doing IDE, SCSI, whether you're doing one terabyte, two terabytes. Yeah, calling in the pre-section and then including including the partition list later on. And it works very, very, very well.
So I've got three answers for you. So the first answer is, like Jesse said, write your own stuff that uses your own heuristics that match your environment and you're percent free. The heuristics we have are to cover, you know, the fact that there are 50 million different types of hardware that Anaconda supports, and I can go back to that slide. And that really makes things a royal pain in a lot of cases. Number two, if you are on Fedora Core 3 or RHEL 4, there is, actually maybe not Fedora Core 3, I don't remember if we turned this off the last minute kernel. There's something called EDD. And this basically grabs a signature in the MBR area of the partition table that can be unique, and then you can actually map up what the BIOS drives are. This is kind of cool. I can actually tell you that the first BIOS drive is this Linux disk. It's -- BIOS disk or something like that. Look at kickstart.py, search for BIOS, you'll figure it out.
That's just BIOS disk.
Yeah, it's been a while since I looked at that code. I may be even maybe over. And the third answer is yes, when the kickstart config syntax is done, redone, I'm sure that something like that will have to be done because it's an extremely common request. It's just not really well.
It's harder in UI. It's easier in the syntax. It's hard, very hard in UI.
Yeah. Actually, it's really hard.
It's really hard either way, but it's much, much harder to UI.
So, in that case, I'm going to let us stop before we get to the very end so that there's time to get downstairs for the panel discussion. And, yeah.